Welcome to the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Turk. Join me as we dive into the personal stories of some of the world's best hospitality professionals. We follow the journey of their ups, downs, and wild turns to find out what it truly takes to make it in the amazing world of hospitality. Listener, if you're running a hospitality business, you already know the work doesn't stop. And most of the time, it's not even the guests that wear you out. It's everything happening behind the scenes. That's why I'm really glad to introduce you to Lodgify, our sponsor for this episode. Lodgify is an all-in-one platform that helps short-term rental hosts and hospitality operators stay organized without needing a dozen different tools. You can manage reservations, keep your calendars synced, communicate with guests, and even collect payments all in one place. And if part of your goal this year is to drive more direct bookings, Lodgify also makes it easy to build your own website so guests can book directly with you. Plus, and I love this one, they include free onboarding so you're not figuring everything out on your own. If you like to spend less time managing the chaos and more time focused on hospitality, try Lodgify with a 60% discount on all their yearly and bi-yearly plans with our code THM60, and that's THM60. Hello, listener. Today, we're going back into the archives to hear the story from Chef David Burke, one of the most famous chefs in the country. And this was an early episode, so you'll tell I'm a little bit nervous, but get into my rhythm as we get going. But Chef David shares so many great stories, so many great pieces of advice that still resonate today. I know you'll enjoy this episode. Welcome to another episode of the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. Today, I'm very excited to have Chef David Burke, award-winning chef, restaurateur, culinary pioneer, and inventor. Welcome to the show, Chef David.
All right, nice to be here.
Well, Chef, let's jump in like we always do. What was your first job that made you fall in love with hospitality?
Well, you know, I was a dishwasher. I was a dishwasher in a hotel in my hometown. And, it was just a high school job. And it was in a pretty good kitchen when I look back. You know, it was a Sheraton at the time. And the food was really good, and it was exciting, and the camaraderie was good. And even though I was a dishwasher, it felt like I was part of creating those meals.
That's awesome. And so I know a lot of people that we've talked to that are all leaders in their companies started as dishwashers. So it's amazing to see that you were as well. But looking back, I know there's a story you told that I found that I think is pretty special for people listening. Is there was a gentleman named Jose you were working with, and you were in high school. Maybe came in a little too much partying, and he kind of gave you a story. Can you touch on that and how maybe that guided you into get into culinary school?
Well, he was after I was a dishwasher, and I had a couple of prep cook jobs, et cetera, and I couldn't really land a cook job, and no one wanted to teach me. Finally, get a job with this guy at a country club. His name was Jose. He had to be about 30. I was about 17, and maybe he wasn't even 30. And he was desperate for a broiler cook, so I interviewed with him. Huge country club, still around, beautiful one. And he's like, "Listen, just go up to the manager, tell him you're a broiler cook, not a prep cook. I'll teach you." Because I begged him to teach me. I said, "Just teach me. I can do it." I said, "No one wants its job. I can't get from making salads to be a line cook unless someone's going to take the time to break me in, right?"
Mm-hmm.
I agreed to go up and basically lie to the manager and tell him I was the chef said, "Just tell him don't tell him you're a prep cook. We don't need a prep cook." Anyway, so I did, and he taught me a lot. And the more he gave me, the more he did. The more he gave me, the more he did. And I was really good. He said, like, he goes, "You've got hands, you know, the hand-eye coordination, the..." You know, people don't realize when you work on a line, you have to be coordinated. You have to have rhythm, you know, it's like a sport, you know. It's like, you know, if you're busy on a broiler, on a grill, you gotta manage a lot with your body and your mind at the same time. And I could do it. And then, you know, I came in one day I was out all night drinking or something, and I was getting sick by the broiler. I wanted to go home. He's like, I said, Chef, you know, if you won't go home. He goes, it's none of that. He goes, you're not going home. He goes, you don't feel good because you, he had said, your own doing. He, so he, there was two broilers. We only used one for lunch. So he put, turned on both of them high and pulled that. He gave me a 5-pound like pail to puke in. And he said, you stand here all day. What, he ain't going no more. And then he explained why he did it, because he didn't, you know, he explained his situation about how, you know, he thought that it was an opportunity not to pass up and not take for granted the job I had and the opportunities that lay ahead of me if I was to be focused, basically. And then he had got sidetracked because he got his wife pregnant when he was my age and he couldn't go to school, and that he wanted to see, he didn't want to see something like that happen to me. So basically that was it.
Man, so shout out to Jose, wherever he's at, getting you on track there.
Well, you know what's great about Jose is he lives not far from me, but he, later on, the culinary school, the country club sent him to the CIA. And I happened to see him up there that day because I was making a commencement speech, and I saw him up at the school as a student, you know, as a continuing ed student, and then we were hugging. So I invited him to the dinner that night. So his dream came true anyway. So
that's awesome, man. Yeah. So as you're coming up, you know, it's, how were your parents about you working in a kitchen at that age, like in high school and doing that? Was that something they were cool with, or is that you just wanted to make money?
Well, my mom worked in a hotel. That's why I got the job. She was working there in the housekeeping department. So that's how I got in. And my cousin was the dishwasher. Her cousin, not mine, older guy, 10 years old. He was like a dishwasher, kind of a hippie Vietnam vet guy. And he, and some of the guys like that were in the kitchen. You know, they were like, 30 years old. I was 15, 16, whatever it was. So my mom likely working there, but she knew everybody. And my dad was like, you know, he just thought it was a cook, you know, job. When I told my dad I want to be a chef, he was crazy pissed. It's like, you know, upset.
Yeah. Like,
we got to convince you that this is not a good move. You know, I was a smart kid. I graduated high school 3 years, which led me to work a full year as a cook before I went to the CIA. But it was not, listen, when you look back, it was not a career choice back then. Being a chef was not even a profession until 1977 or 78. It was really a service industry job, like being a janitor or a maid or a utility person. And that's what it was looked at. It was called a service job. Custodial, basically, something like that, a food and beverage or food service. Cafeterias, things like that. So we've come a long way in 45 years or so from since then, 40. But it was a struggle for me to convince him that this is what I wanted to do. But I had no idea what lie ahead. I just wanted to be creative and run my own kitchen and basically not be a 9-to-5er. You know, I didn't want to be in an office. I didn't really know what an office was, but I knew that there was something about being in the kitchen that was exciting and different every day, and teamwork. It was like not working. It was, to me, it was like not working. It was like you're building stuff. It's like hanging, you know, when we were kids, we hung out in the woods and we built tree houses, right? That's not really work. Well, you're lugging wood from half a mile and climbing trees. That, to me, being in a kitchen has never been about physical labor. It's hard. But it's never, I never look at them, you know, there's been times when I said it's a drag, yes. But yeah. Have I hated my career?
Well, I know as a high school kid, you were pretty tough. You were a wrestler, you were an athlete, but you're in this kitchen with grown men, right? You're a kid. What was that like? The kind of eyes kind of wide open when that was happening?
I mean, you know what? I had my mother who worked there. I had her cousin who was in the kitchen. So I had a buffer. Nobody really.
All right.
I was a likable guy. You know, I was quiet back then. I did, and I worked. I was a hard worker. My dad, you know, I always worked around the yard. I liked working, and I liked to do a good job. So, and I kept my mouth shut, and then I was very respectful of others. So, you know, I was a pretty, you know, and I did a good job. I wasn't lazy. You know, I couldn't be lazy in my house. My dad was like, I was the oldest too, so I had them do things. Take out the garbage, cut the lawn, help fix the car, do this thing, you know, whatever it was. Whatever he said, I did. Whether I knew how to do it or not, that was just, go do it. You figured it out.
I was like, yes, sir, I'm on it.
Go go up on the roof and fix the antenna because the TV's broke. Like, it's snowing out. He's like, good, you won't hurt yourself if you fall off the roof.
Oh, I love it. All right, so good. So I see you were able to handle yourself in there. You decided to go to culinary school. How was that step? Was that straight out of high school that you went there, or did you go to college first?
I had a full year of working with Jose and others. As my senior year, I didn't go to school. I got my diploma, but I had like a work study program, which was kind of illegal, but they let it happen because I had a varsity letter as a wrestler. So I had my phys ed, I had all my other credits. So they kind of, you know, you're supposed to go 4 years of phys ed, 4 years of something else, I forget. So they kind of like, because I applied for the Culinary Institute of America as a junior, they let me not go senior. So that was super helpful for my career because by the time I got to the culinary school, I already worked in a really good place, a couple of really good places. So I wasn't just out of high school at work and some of my classmates that worked at TGI Fridays or Ground Round or something like that. So I actually knew food and I knew how to butcher and I knew how to work the line and I knew how to puke in a bucket.
Yeah. And so was it easy for you when you got there? Or did you learn things that you really didn't know?
Well, CIA was not easy back then. There were some classes that were easier for me. Most of the cooking classes were easier. But, you know, sanitation, nutrition, wine classes, those things didn't interest me that much. But I still did good. I did good as that. I was the most likely to succeed candidate when I graduated. And as I took school seriously. I was into it. I still into it. I love this career. I like the opportunity that it affords. And there's every day it has a new opportunity. You don't really get to be finished. You know, yeah. Even if you're the CEO of your own company or you own your restaurant, you still have things to learn. You know, like this, you turn a corner and there's something new. You know, you're designing something, you're working on a new dish, you're fixing something, you're mentoring, you're teaching, you're buying a bakery, now you're in the bakery business, you know, things like that. So there's always another branch of something happening. Or like I want to do sushi myself now, so tired of ordering. I want to go work behind a sushi counter and learn. Because I think, I hate not knowing how to do things. At least that. So I can there and just make. If worse comes to worse, guy doesn't show up, I can at least do something.
Yeah, with your creativity, I would love to try some of that sushi. You gotta let us know when you're ready.
You gotta make the time, you know. And that's, time is really the most precious commodity. That's what it is.
Going back to time and getting out of culinary school, you start traveling with your time. How does that happen? Do you have to find them and find these, you know, iconic chefs you work with around Europe, or do they know you're in the culinary school and they find you? No. Or how does that work back then?
I had a chef in school I thought hated this. He was so hard on me. And then he recommended me the last couple of weeks of school at a job fair. He recommended that I work for a very wealthy family in Norway, which got me a ticket to Europe. So I was hired by this family that usually hired a French chef from Cordon Bleu. They decided to go American. They had businesses in Greenwich, Connecticut. Anyway, I went to Oslo.
You were like 21?
At 20.
Yeah. 20, so 20-year-old, yeah. Heading to Norway.
Okay. Well, I told my dad I was moving to Norway, and he was like, what exit is that? I said, I got to Norway. I worked there for the summer, and then I took a month off and went all through Europe on a train, which was great. So I went to Italy, went to Germany, went to France, Holland, Belgium, and then back up to Scandinavia to get my airline ticket back. But the beauty of it is I wasn't afraid to move back there and work in one of the other countries in a restaurant because I realized that the language barrier wasn't that great. You know, I mean, I could do it. I could get in the kitchen and learn how to work without speaking French. I went to school in France without speaking French to learn pastry because we visualize and you translate and it looks see kind of. Yeah, you can translate a recipe once you have it, but it's really the technique you're there to learn. It was hard because you get picked on a bit too. I was a good cook when I went to pastry school, but I wasn't a pastry person, and I was working in great restaurants, and you know, when you don't have a language barrier, you might not understand what they say to do. I'll say, oh, do this, and you think it's that.
Yeah, was it like, hey, the American boy's here. Let's do all the hard work.
They give you the tasks they don't want to do, too. So you just do it, and then you make sure you do it well, then you continue to work, and then you thank them for the opportunity, because basically you're working for free, and it's another part of schooling. You know, yep. You're in the best. If you go in the best restaurants in the world, then you can even get in there for 3, 4, 5 weeks to learn and not have to pay them. That's great. But a lot of people wouldn't do that. You know, you got to live in a youth hostel. You got to save money. You got to, you're eating ham and cheese sandwiches every day. You're eating at the restaurant, of course. But, you know, it takes a lot of guts to go out and do that when you look back at it, to just uproot yourself and move to a country, whether you're male or female. More so with a female, I think. When you just go and live in a small room in a small hotel for 3 months, you know, in a foreign country, and just to learn. And there's a dedication there. There's a desire to be great.
You work with a bunch of different chefs when you're there. I'm not gonna ask who's your favorite, but you're all different styles that you were learning. Was there one that really stuck out? Like, wow, this is one that, you know, I really enjoy.
I tell you that when I worked with Georges Blanc, it was very organized and meticulous, and he's a very soft-spoken, wonderful guy. And his kitchen is run, family kind of run, very smooth. And then I worked with Trois Gros, the two brothers, in a super modern kitchen, and more nouvelle cuisine-ish, and just more... But regimented, and the guys there, they worked, you know, you worked split shifts, and they played soccer in the afternoon. They weren't the friendliest batch. Very competitive. And even within that kitchen, they were competitive. And then I worked with, but the food was avant-garde. And then I worked with Marc Minot, who was the meanest, mean guy. But you wouldn't know. Sometimes the mean guys, you don't realize they're mean because they like you. They're spending time with you. If they didn't like it, they wouldn't even give you the time of day. But his creativity was beyond. And he was more, I would have to say he was more original. And he had some of his ideas were just brilliant. And I him and Georges Blanc and I became friendly, and we would visit. Georges and I worked on Singapore Airlines together. And Marc Minot came to the U.S. for a couple of weeks years ago. And we went out to dinner together, came to the restaurant, had him in my convertible. We had a couple of nights that were hair curling. And it was a joy to have been able to reciprocate what he taught me. Even though when I was a young kid, they would, myself included, they would never think I would become a well-known chef. It was just, you know, but it started with their help.
That's amazing. And so
learning is, if you keep learning, I mean, like, you know, you keep learning. I worked for this guy, Pierre Hermé, a great pastry chef at Fourchon. He doesn't, I don't know if he realizes I was in that kitchen, because they see tons of students coming through. But I'll remember because I was in awe of these people. You know, they might see 100 students, like I train 100 cooks.
Right. But
cooks remember you. And if you do ever hit it big or you want to drop a note, it's always appreciated, right? I get calls in the middle of the night sometimes. Some guy got 3 stars. He calls me up drunk from being loyal, sir. Oh, or San Francisco, and like, hey, chef, I got 3, you know, I opened my restaurant, I got 3 stars. You fired me, but I love you. Blah, blah, blah.
And I love that.
Please try it.
So you're traveling Europe, you're called back home, or you decide to come back home, and...
Well, I called and worked for Wally Malouf, who was at Le Cobas. We worked at a very good French restaurant up in the outside of New York. I worked 2 years with him. And everybody that worked there, the waiters and the rest of the cooks, except for me and him, were Belgian and French. So the language that was spoke there in the kitchen was French, except for me and him. And it was a really famous country French restaurant owned by the guys who owned like Caravelle in New York. And I honed my skills there, and I learned the classic cuisine of French food, the Côte Basque then at the time. Then I left and worked to New York City to work for Daniel Malouf at the Hotel Plaza Athenee when it opened in 84, late 84, or summer of 84. Spent several months working with him, got through the holidays, and then the chef, well, Charlie Palmer called me to be the sous chef at the River Cafe because I had met Charlie working at the French restaurant in the country. He was working at a country club. So the River Cafe sous chef job took precedent over the fish cook job with Danielle, and I jumped ship. And I was 2 years with Charlie. Within those 2 years of a sous chef, I went to France and worked for those great people. And then I was going to open Oriole with Charlie, but they offered me the job at the River Cafe to stay, which I took the job only if I could stop for 6 months and learn pastry, which is how I got over to pastry school in Paris, paid for by the owner of the River Cafe. When I came back in 87, 88, I was fresh out of pastry school, took over the River Cafe for Charlie Palmer. He went to open Oriole, and I spent another 5 years as the chef of the River Cafe until 92. And I represented the United States in the Olympics in Tokyo in 88. We won the Olympics. I also got several good reviews, created my own style, more importantly than anything else. And then opened in 92, went to open Park Avenue Cafe with the founder of TGI Fridays and Smith & Walensky, Alan Stillman. Spent 10 years with Alan. We opened a slew of restaurants together, steakhouses and fine dining. And I went public, made some money. Then I opened a David Burton Donatella on the Upper East Side with a woman named Donatella Pia. Hit a grand slam, and then I started.
That was your first, right? So I want to unpack something. Yeah. So I want to come back to when you first become exec chef at the River Cafe. That was your first executive chef role, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty big one, too.
Right. And so I'm curious, because you're a young gun, right? 24, 26. 25, 26, when you win the, you know, 3 stars from New York Times. But what was that like to become a leader of men and women in that kitchen when you're a young guy and you've never really been head of the chef?
Since I was the sous chef there, it made it a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
But I had left, and Charlie was leaving, and he was taking his crew. And Larry Ford Jones was before Charlie. So there were I had fear. And like, fear is a good motivator for me. I don't like to fail. So when I have fear, man, I get really anxious and I get moving, you know,
yes.
Figure it out. I don't like to be boxed into a corner. So I'm a fighter. And I figured it out. So I got the pastry down pat. I knew how to run a kitchen. I didn't know how to order all the food correctly. I didn't know all of that stuff, but that was taken care of. I let the stuff I didn't know bother me. And then and the owner was like, the stuff you do know is why we're giving you the job. We're not giving you the job because of the stuff you don't know. We think what you do know is head and shoulders above anybody else. He goes, the reason you're getting the job is because the rest of the staff told me you deserve the job and you can do this. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Did it. And I was shocked because I used to yell and scream at everybody. That's important.
Well, that's because that was old school chef.
Yeah. Right. But but the results were backed up.
So were you doing stuff that the owner did not like, or was he like, hey man, you have full control in this kitchen?
No, Buzzy O'Keefe gave us full control. He did edit somewhat. He never told us you had to do this or that, but he was way ahead of his time. He was all about getting the best peach when the best peach was available. He would always say, you don't need to put sauce on a good steak. And he was, but trying to tell a young culinary guy back then that you can't put steak sauce on a steak, or you can't serve foie gras. You can't. I remember throwing a shit fit because I couldn't make my own ice cream. Think about it now. I don't want to make my own ice cream. But back then, you know, we had to do, in order to get 3 stars, you had to be with the elite. You had to work that way. You had to want to do things. I mean, we had a pastry menu with 24 desserts. 24 desserts. We had the best pastry program in the city. And I was a kid. But you know what? I was tireless. And I would drive people. I could get 150% out of anybody just by motivating them. And there's a skill there. Encouraging them and telling them that they can do this. Like, I would challenge people and say, listen, you got to make 100 chocolate butterflies. I said, you can do this. And they're like, well, I never did it. I said, the first guy that made chocolate butterflies never did it either. I mean, that's when you start. And then the pride that they would take when they put that final chocolate butterfly on top of the dessert was like, and then you got them. Then, you know, a student, when you teach people, it's better than paying them or pay people. But when you teach somebody a little something every day and they're getting better, they take that home with them, and knowledge is power, and they feel it.
And like you said, you started developing your style there, like really coming into your own. Was there something that stands out in your mind? Like, man, I got something here. Like this one, you know I got it.
We were doing, we had the best view in the world of for a restaurant. So what I started doing was presenting food architecturally and getting, so we were doing Instagram food before Instagram. We were saying, look at me, man, look at me on a plate. Don't look in your lover's eyes. Look at this food. This is a new guy in the kitchen. This is what we do. And you know, and you got to look at it. For me to take my creme brulee recipe, and it's the same one that Charlie Palmer had, and the same one that Larry. How is mine going to stand out? I have to prove to people that I'm better, or that I'm worthy. So what do I need to do? I need to outstyle, outthink, get up earlier, stay out later, whatever it may be. And I got to drive. I have to prove that I am worthy. I don't have to just. I don't want to just take the job because I got the job. I want to leapfrog above this job. I want this job. I don't want the guy coming after me to ever be as good, you know? So I want to make, you know, I'm swinging for the fences.
I love it. I look back at some of the pictures from when you were in that restaurant. They still hold up. Yeah. Across the board.
We were way ahead of our time. And I look back now and laugh because I had such fear of critics. And I laugh at a critic.
Yeah.
Laugh at the fact that they thought they had so much power. I mean, yes, you can learn, and we all needed editing as we were growing and we're younger and we made some mistakes. But for someone to try to slam you for the effort that's being made by the what they call the man in the arena, the person doing the work, taking the chances, putting in these hours. Some are very good writers and some just don't get it. But, you know, the expert is the person that is working in the field, not the person that's pointing out what's gone bad or what's gone wrong. Now, yes, you'll make mistakes. If you're smart, you'll read them and you'll edit them and you'll learn from them. And then there's times where it's nonsensical criticism. But back then, you were, a review was very important to you and your career. So you had to, you know, you'd work 100 days and we're waiting for that critic to come in. And the pressure is involved with being a high-powered chef or running a restaurant. You put a lot of it on yourself, but it's built in. If you want to be in the elite chef world in a city like New York City, you're going to pay for it. You're going to have to go get it. You know, no one's handing it to you. And, you know, and you're tested by your staff. You're tested by your clientele. You're tested by the critics. And you've got to test yourself. So you need to be ready. And I loved it. I mean, But my edge was I was very creative and I had no fear of failure. I wasn't afraid to get laughed at or make a mistake. And I think that's important when you try to be creative. You got to understand the basics, and more than the basics, you have to master the classics and why certain things go together well, and understand why the classic cuisine is built this way and what ingredients go with each other from a seasonal standpoint, a geographic standpoint, a digestive standpoint, a visual, a textural, sees all that stuff. And when you do understand that, then it's a little easier to get the paintbrush to the canvas.
No, I love it. And you mentioned something about the critics, right? So at 26, you did get a critic that loved you, gave you 3 stars in the New York Times, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So is that when you became like the young stud in New York City and people started calling you like, hey, we want you to come with us? Is that kind of what kicked it off?
Well, people came, man. One of the interesting things, I have that review framed, is that was the first time in the history of the New York Times that they ever put a photo with the review. It was a photo and it was a chocolate butterfly. That's why I use that analogy.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that. I got to go back and look.
It was 1988, and I think it was May or March. I have it somewhere. And then the following week, they used the picture again, but I was the first picture. Oh, here it is.
That's awesome. I love that you have that framed. That's so cool.
And now it's a 3-star review. It's not the best review in the world, but it's 3 stars. And yep. And it's got the photo. Now, I made those chocolate butterflies, and and people were like, what a pain in the ass it is. I said, it makes a difference. Trust me, when people see us. And that was the butterfly that when I won the Tokyo Olympics, they asked us to explain what we made. And I made this chocolate dessert with a log cabin, maple ice cream, represented, Maple represented the U.S. A log cabin with Abe Lincoln, and it had this little homestead thing on the plate. It had the butterfly that represented freedom in America, and people were like, this is it. And I
was. So you run around with that review in your kitchen. See, I told you guys, it's the
butterfly. I brought this because I'm writing a book. I had to show my the writer within a book on my career and my journey, and I was telling him that the other day. So I just happened. It's usually in my office upstairs. I had it down here because we were discussing it. So.
Well, I love I got to see it.
So I framed him, and that's the original newspaper. That was May, New York Times, May 6, 1988. Yep.
Time flies, man, you see. But you're still continue on this journey. So you're now the young chef that's crushing it. 92 comes around. Like you mentioned, you go to the Park Avenue Cafe. How does that come on? They come calling you, or are you looking for deals
they
you made?
They called me. They called me. And I was going to do a restaurant with Junior Prawn, Robert De Niro. It was time to move on. And then Alan Silver called me with that location. We made a smart deal. It was a great move because he taught me business and marketing and taking chances. Man, this guy took chances. He did advertising, marketing. He had big cojones and he put his money where his mouth is. I learned a lot from him in that organization. We opened steakhouses and travel the country, and it wasn't 3-star Michelin company. Mm-hmm. Could have went that route and easily got there, in my opinion. But the business aspect of it, and the got me enough money to start my own company, and that's all that matters. And that happened in '92, so we had a great run, and I taught them a lot, and they taught me a lot, and that's a win-win.
And Smith & Wolensky is still a great brand name, and you had a big part in that. The one here on Miami Beach, I go to still all the time.
That was the hardest opening.
Why is that? I'm a Miami guy. Why was that so hard?
Well, it was 700 people.
Mm-hmm.
Opening night, no air conditioning in September. The Miami Dolphins, Nick Bonacani Foundation was coming in, 700 people. All of them had raw bar. We had no power all day, and I had 3 broken ribs. From the night before out on Collins Avenue where some bouncer was an off-duty cop. I guess he decided I looked like a guy that needed his ball.
Yeah, that happens on some.
You know what?
Once in a while, yeah.
Goes on, man. I got up and went in, 3 broken ribs. I learned something. I learned that you never tell a cop that he hits like your sister.
Oh, I'm crying over here. Listen, I'm crying. You can't see it, but I'm crying.
What a great, and that's an iconic location still up.
It's still great.
Stay. So we got our power at 4:30. We had to buy ice blocks and grind them down in Buffalo Chopper for the ice for the 700 people, 70 raw bar towers.
That's something.
That much prepped at it, and it was brutally hot. And you know what? Back then, there weren't a lot of people to steal from. We didn't have a Cracker Jack staff.
No.
You had Joe's and you had the Forge and you had a couple of hotels and a couple of those. The Mango Gang guys had restaurants like Robin Haas and Mark Bilotello and
Alan Susser. Yep.
Alan, yeah, those guys were down there, but there wasn't a lot else down there to get from. But what an experience.
And
what an iconic restaurant still. So the Pork Shank guy put on the menu. And when I first put that pork shank on the menu, when we opened Bologna and Porcelli, the executive team that I worked for, Alan Stillman and his business partners, were like, nah, we don't think the pork should go on the menu. No one's going to order pork in New York. And I hit the roof. I was so passionate about this dish. But I was slamming things around. And Alan, the smart guy he is, he's like this. He laughs. He goes, damn. If you want on the menu, we'll put on a menu for a month. If it doesn't sell, it's okay to take it off the menu. I'm like, fair.
Deal. Yeah.
Wins best dish in America. 1996. Best dish in America. A pork dish in USA Today on top. Number 2 dish is John George or Thomas Keller or Daniel Ballou. Number 1, DB's pork. The one that nobody said no one's going to like. I was like, that's why you got to. That's where the critic doesn't count. That's when, I know what I want. I was in Germany. I saw these people lining up eating. It was Weinhoxens, and I'm like, I'm putting this on a thing. And I did a little French technique, and I put it with jalapeno applesauce, made it a little bit Latin, a little bit modern. man, is it good. And it was not, it's still on a Switzerland.
Yeah, and I've had it, and it's amazing. So I didn't know that story where they're like, no, you cannot have this.
Well, you know, I could have just said, okay, you're right. And I did not. But, you know, sometimes you got to fight for what you think is right. Even though it's just a plate of food, it's not a plate. It's a culture shift, right? It's you know, we're here to educate. And, you know, we can't, if it doesn't sell, okay, take it off. But let's try things. Let's give it a shot. Let's be different. Let's dare to be different.
I love it. So you crush it with Smith & Wolinski. You do your openings. You make some money. And then you get to your first restaurant that you mentioned. And this is another part I always like to find out, because that's very different than working for somebody. Now you're the guy.
Now you're not working 80 hours a week. You're working 100.
Right. So what was that like opening your first place? Was it just like you were in it looking for the perfect spot the whole time?
Everything you learned? Here, because I needed to get it open. I had using my own money, my partner's money. We put up, I don't know, $400K each or something like that. And then we didn't make money for a couple. You know, we still had bills. We built it. Beautiful restaurant, though. Very creative. The food. And I had sous chefs that were coming back to me saying, I just want to be part of your restaurant. I work the line. And so everybody in that kitchen was a sous chef or a chef. There was no beginners. And it was just shift pay. And we partied and cooked and yelled. And it was like the Oakland Raiders, I guess, in the kitchen. It was like this bad boy team of people that I had fired and pulling out. But they could cook. They could cook. It was like, you know, and they were like.
It's the Renegades.
Always the Renegades. And we got it open. Huge hit. And then we started printing money, making, doing well. I had the smoking limousine outside. We had these beautiful new, and we had the whimsical dishes, the bake, you know, that's when the style got, because it wasn't as, Parquet Cafe was really busy, and so was Smith & Wolinski restaurant. Now I had a 900 seat restaurant, and the food was just, I wish I could see it today. Some of the dishes, it's like, and the design, and I was working the front of the house and the back. We were taking Le Cirque's business. It was great.
Yeah, and you're just winning, and you're doing
10 years, and that ran its course. And then, you know, opened Bloomingdale's, a few other stuff, opened the best steakhouse in Chicago. Fast forward, you know, wrote books, did TV. And
that's what I want to get into, right? Because you got this awesome restaurant. When do you start adding restaurants, right? So you opened this in 2003.
It's 2 years after it was open. Bought out Donatella because I needed to expand the staff too. And we were butting heads a little bit. So I brought in a different partner, and then we expanded to Chicago, a few others. That relationship ended not well. With
the new partner or with Donatella?
Oh, yeah, the new partner, we were trying, you know, we expanded, but it wasn't. There was two different visions. He wanted to spend more money, and I wanted to make more money. He wanted to, you know, so we can go back and forth on what happened. But, you know, then the company wanted to own my name, and I wouldn't let that happen. So we separated. So we some of it got dissolved. Some of it went to me. Some of it went to them. And then I started opening it. And now we're back where I am today.
Yeah, and so for like chefs coming up that are owning their place, you know, you take on partners. What advice would you tell them if they're looking for a partner? Because it's a marriage. What advice would you give?
Oh, you know, listen. Most chefs didn't go to business school. And we're very trusting, and we're entrepreneurial, and we're not. You got to make sure you have, it's like a marriage, you know. You got to protect yourself. Now, if it's your first gig and you're making a name for yourself and you're not put up any money, listen, it's the golden rule. Protect your name, protect your brand, know your worth, and that's it. Well, the guy who puts up the money is going to have say, or the people, because they're backing you. So you got to work. You got to prove yourself. You know, until you're owning more than half of the business and or this, you got to watch the deal, how it's written, because you don't want to put all that work into something and just out of a whim have to start over because you can't get. And this is a very passionate business, and many, many people don't understand what goes into this business because they think all business is the same, and it's not. The tech business and the restaurant business are very different, especially when it comes to the type of employees and the hours and the benefits and the pay and the corporate ladder is completely different. And so you got to be careful. It's a great business. If you're going to get in business, make sure you have the buyout clauses and make sure, listen, they can be your friend and your business with them and you lose your friendship.
Yep.
Because, you know, there has to be realistic expectations on what the payback's going to be and how fast or slow it's going to go. And you're going to have to work hard. You know, it's not a joke. Business, and it's harder every year. It gets harder and harder for guys like us and girls like us in the rest of business to keep pivoting. I mean, we just got through a pandemic. Now we're in a recession. Who knows what's...
Yeah. They just keep throwing stuff at us here.
People, and the younger, there's some really great young culinary people out there that are willing to do whatever it takes and learn and learn and learn. Like there was, but not as many as there used to be. And I'll explain it to you how I feel. Years ago, it was a blue-collar job being a cook.
You started, yep.
Well, yeah, and you wanted that opportunity, and you would work hard. You didn't count hours. You worked on your day off. You went in early to learn how to butcher or do pastry, whatever. You know, yeah, and you got chef asked you to stay late. You stay late, work your day off, no problem. You were loyal to him, loyal to the investor or whatever it was. Fast forward, Wolfgang Clark, et cetera, Admiral Flay, you name it. These guys that are making headlines and TV shows and driving Maseratis and flying all over and selling pots and pans and cookbooks and this and that. It's very glamorous. And it's like some people that have made it to the elite level of the food world. So it looks more appealing and it's sexy, right? Food Network is sexy, right? Blue collar kid wants to go get into the white collar kid wants to get into the job. And the white collar parents are like, no problem. Susie knows how to bake. We'll open a milk. Billy's a grill witty. He makes bolognese. He loves to cook. We'll put him in school. They get out of school. And then they realize they got to work 7 days a week. They got to work 80, 60 hours a week. They can't call in sick. They're going to get fired. They get yelled at. They get blah, blah, blah. Next thing you know, you're not getting the caliber of employee is not necessarily the same. They might be talented. Might want to work, but they don't have that hunger that I once saw years ago. Not as many that are coming through the doors. And when the River Cafe, we had a line of people out the door. They were willing to work for free just to learn because of what we were doing. And people came from Norway. They came from L.A. They came from Canada. And I had a house across the street. I was recently divorced, so I had extra rooms, and we would put people up. And it was like, room and board, baby. Get to work. You know, I mean, I'd hire a guy and he'd come interview in his confirmation suit, man. I'm like, that suit doesn't even fit you. And I'm like, when can you start? He goes, right away. I said, how about right now? He says,
I'm in.
On the line with his dress shoes, his feet are bleeding, and he's doing a 12-hour shift. I'm like, best. Well, I don't want to sound like the old guy, and I had to walk uphill to school, but I'm the old guy that walked uphill to school.
Yeah, and you're part of that transition too. You came in like that right time, right? I was part of the wine and food festival here in Miami Beach a lot with the TV and all this. You know, I worked at the Lowe's Miami Beach Hotel and all y'all there.
The new industry, you got to think about it. There was none of this stuff. If you're probably a little older, if you're a certain age, you saw all the change. You were part of it.
Mm-hmm.
This in the 70s and 80s, it didn't exist. The chefs didn't have cookbooks. I mean, Julia Child did, but she wasn't a restaurant chef. You didn't have food festivals. You didn't have the Food Network. You didn't have all these culinary schools. You didn't have the respect that the profession has today. And it wasn't cool. See, when I was a kid, if you had a tattoo and a nose ring, you were either a sailor or an ex-con or a biker. You weren't putting pink icing on a cupcake.
Well, listen, you started getting involved in that a little bit, right? Did you like make a choice of, hey, all my guys, contemporaries are making cookbooks and pots and pans and selling stuff. Did you make a decision to do that?
I had a publisher came to me and said, I want to write your cookbook. I love what you do.
You had to go for it. Really, go for it.
That was my first. I wrote two books. I'm writing a third book, and it's a storybook about what we're talking about. And it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we talk about the pitfalls of the industry, the greatness of it, the excitement of it, the highs and lows, the ups and downs, the late nights, the drugs, the alcohol, the sexiness of it, and also the tragedies of what goes with anything that is related to nighttime business, nightclub,
drinks,
or many celebrity, the word celebrity involved in it, and which is something that should be addressed when the younger people get into the business. I don't think is as rampant as a, and you know, you got a city like New York, city never sleeps. What do you do after work? You got to go out and wind up, right? So you wind up, you got to just be careful and have a balance in your social calendar as a young person. And not, we're not taught that as young people. It's easy to get drawn into the late night thing. Hopefully you can, you know, you weather storm and not have the personality that takes you a little too far out there.
But that's true.
For many people, they come and go. They come and go because this is a business that'll eat. Not only will it eat, first of all, it's hard enough to be alive in this business without any distractions because you dedicate so many hours a week to it. I mean, the divorce rate is extremely high because of the hours and the dedication and the stress. And the stress factor is super high. The suicide, the whole amount of things that are within the and within the realm of the restaurant business. And the dropout rate is tremendous. You know, so but at the end of the day, I wouldn't change it.
That's true.
For an exciting, there's never a dull day.
Well, now you've got your, like you said, you transitioned, you got rid of your partners, you're doing your thing, and you're building your restaurants again. I think the last count was about 20 restaurants?
Yeah, not 15. See, we 15, could have sold, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of it, but we have a couple ahead of us, big ones. One's in north of Palm Beach, a town called Lake Park. And, yep. And then we have one in White Plains in New York and another big complex in Jersey and New York City. We're doing some on Park Avenue in an office building. I think there's something else out there, but Charlotte. We're doing a pizzeria fast casual concept.
Nice.
And we're expanding. Yeah, so we're busy. We bought a bakery and... again, I want to do a cooking school one day I want to do a reality show here in my house where I have some students living with me for 5 months. It's boot camp. And they really just learn. They learn from one chef's mentality and lifestyle what I do and what I think they should do to get themselves on the right track to be great at what they want to do.
I like it. Burke's Boot Camp. I'll be watching. Be watching that one. So as you have this company now, you know, you've got a lot of young talent, I'm assuming, coming through. Is there, how do you nurture that? Because just imagine having someone like you in your kitchen say, I need this pork shank on this menu. Do you have someone like that now? Do you allow that to happen?
We do have, well, there's layers of corporate chefs. Carmine, my main guy, Carmine DiGiovanni, and then we have pastry chefs, and we work with them. We do give them freedoms. I love to see somebody that's feisty about what they put on the menu. And we encourage them to send their specials every night on, we have an Instagram page that's collective of all chefs, a little bit of a competition. And we have a central buyer. So we might buy soft shells for everybody that week, or we're doing something with Shark right now. And then we keep the ball in the air with the creativity. And if something's really good, we'll put it on the menu. But yes, we don't, we're ultra creative anyway, but I like to see people wanting to put their name on the menu or their dish, but it has to work.
Right. That's got to work there. I get it. You know, Chef, you've been all over the world. You're opening tons of restaurants. You're getting your third book going. But if you went back to young David, the dishwasher at the Sheraton, if he was starting today as that dishwasher, what advice would you give him if he was starting out today? Different world.
I would, you know what? Stay focused, read, travel, eat, ask questions, document everything. You know, and it's easy to document now with the iPhones, right? But and always learn, volunteer and learn. Go learn something. Learn something new every day. If you don't know how to make pizza dough, go make pizza dough. You know, even a simple thing. You don't know how to make a pump souffle, you know what it is? I know how to do it. I'll teach you, because there's certain things that even though they were in vogue 20 years ago, people don't make them because they're too hard. We tend to move there. And that's what happened with the restaurant business. It used to be about who's going to make the best souffle, who's going to do the bone out the Dover soles, who's going to, because those took skill. So instead of tourneing a carrot now, they just dice it because it's easier. Because you don't need a craft, so you don't need someone skilled in carving vegetables to do it. Now, at the end of the day, does it make that much sense? When you look at the old photos and you see the tourne veg and it looks kind of silly, maybe, or looks outdated, it doesn't mean it didn't teach you how to carve, how to turn, include a mushroom. So, you know, look back on some older stuff and learn. And if you don't know how to make puff pastry, maybe you don't have to. Maybe you never will. But you should know what's involved. Look at macaroons, another one. I mean, you know, learn how to make them. You know, I make cheesecake lollipops. I mean, go butcher a whole fish. Go to a market. Go like I said, go make some sushi rice and make some sushi. Make some mistakes. Make mistakes and learn from them. That's the only advice I can give. And also, just the other thing is you need to have a outlet for your and enjoy some life. You can't just work. And I did this. All I did was I was consumed by work. And you need a little bit of an outlet. Everybody, and I found it finally now. It took me decades where you can, whether it's nature, taking a walk, some people exercise, some people have more family lives and busy, but you need something that so you can shut off the teapot, the percolator of what goes through a chef's mind.
Yeah, I think that's great advice and a great place to end our conversation. Chef, I appreciate you taking the time to spend with me and our listeners, and I can't wait for your sushi restaurant to open here on South Beach, man. Let's get it going here in Miami.
Yeah, soon. Again, let's get in touch because I'll be in Florida soon. I'll be coming down quite a bit. We're building that place.
I would love it. Thank you. Good to meet you.
Wow.
This podcast is brought to you by Biscayne Coffee. Biscayne Coffee was founded with a giving spirit and a big idea to enjoy delicious coffee roasted in Miami while helping save Biscayne Bay and the animals that live there. As a former food and beverage director, I can assure you these are some of the best quality beans on the planet. 10% of every coffee sold is donated to nonprofits to help preserve Biscayne Bay for all to enjoy. Visit BiscayneCoffee.com today and use promo code MENTOR at checkout to save 10% on your first order. Drink good coffee and create a good outcome.